Something will. Or it already has. I did notice that when I was in the living room, Marino continues, I couldn't believe all the weird shit in there. The spinning wheels, the little crosses made out of iron nails and red thread, the hourglasses. The more I think about it, Doc, I can't swear the clocks were working. They are now. And antique clocks have to be wound manually. They have to be constantly adjusted if they're to be in sync. I listen to everything going on around us and hear blowing air and the clocks. Someone's been in here, Marino says. That's my point. Someone who has a key and the alarm code. Possibly. Not possibly. Absolutely, unless you're talking about a ghost who can pass through walls. He's agitated and edgy as he looks at his phone, finding a number. Chapter 33. We should leave. I hover near the front door and listen for the response team. I don't detect voices or doors opening and shutting, not so much as a floorboard creaking. Just the wind and the rain and the clocks. I glance at my watch. SWAT has been clearing the house for exactly 6 minutes. It's as if the men have vanished. Tick tock, tick tock. All Marino and I have to do is walk back outside into the storm. It's safer than being in here, or at least that's the way I feel as I look at him, at his wide back turned to me. He has one of his contacts on the line, another female, I can tell, and I realize he's talking to Chanel Gilbert's alarm company. I'm going to repeat this, Marino says, and we're going to write it down. He means I'm going to, and I get a notepad and pen out of my shoulder bag, reminded of my gun again. I slip it out and place it on top of a scene case. It was reset at 10:28 this morning, he's saying to a contact he calls Sweetheart, and there was no activity until 25 minutes past 1 p.m., which is when I disarmed the system. I listen for another moment, and then he ends the call and says to me, how are we supposed to explain something like that? I set the alarm when we left the first time at 10:28, then unset it now. In other words, no one's touched the alarm system in the past 3 hours except me. So how the hell did someone come in here and wind the clocks? It's a damn good thing you were with me the entire time, or they'd say I did it. You couldn't have, and that's ridiculous, I reply. You positive there's no other explanation for why we're hearing the clocks now, but we didn't earlier? What other explanation could there be? But the alarm system has to be armed and disarmed, and it wasn't, so how were the clocks wound? I can only tell you that they have been since we were here last. Maybe there's another way to get in that bypasses the alarm system. Marino is restless, looking and listening as I think of the locked bulkhead doors outside in the flower bed. I'm reminded of the rusting hulk of the Mercedes on the bottom of the sea. It seems the broken-up shipwreck and the bulkhead are somehow the same. Portals to an evil place. Portals to destruction and death. Portals to our ultimate destiny. And I wonder if the bulkhead doors have alarm contacts and are wired to the system. If not, one could access the house that way. No code would be needed, and there would be no record of someone coming in and out. As long as you have a key, I'm describing this to Marino. You could get in through the bulkhead doors and at the very least be in the basement, I'm assuming. Well, if you have a damn key, wouldn't you also have the alarm code and not need to enter the house that way? Not necessarily. He unclips his holstered Glock from the waistband of his soaked shorts and says, I wonder if there was some way the housekeeper could have come back in here to poke around. Maybe she knows a way to do that without touching the alarm system. So she snuck in, and while she was at it, she wound the clocks. Why bother? Habit. People do weird things when they're upset. Or maybe she's crazy. His eyes are wide, his holstered pistol pointed down by his side. You look at all the stuff everywhere, and I'm thinking somebody's a mental case or into bad juju. None of it caught my attention when I was here this morning. I left too abruptly, and I can't stop thinking about the depraved heart videos and how they made me feel and act. Stunned, threatened, angry, sad. Most of all, I was overwhelmed by a sense of urgency. I was too quick to race out of here. If I'd had a chance to look around, I would have wondered if Chanel Gilbert had psychiatric problems or was involved in pagan religions. Either could have made her vulnerable to a predator like Carrie. And I listened for the response team clearing the house. I hear nothing. Then Marino's phone rings. A birdsong ringtone that for an instant confuses both of us. "What the hell is going on, Lappin?" he angrily bursts out the instant he realizes who it is. "Yeah, well, sorry to hear that, but I don't give a shit if you're really sick or not. I sound like I'm in a tomb? Well, guess why? It's because I am. I'm back in the foyer where a lady was found dead this morning, remember? And the doc and I just got back here to finish up the scene of what's turned out to be a homicide, and guess what? The perimeter hasn't been secured, and my backup was nowhere in sight. And guess what else? Chanel Gilbert's Range Rover isn't at the house anymore. You heard me. Nope, I'm not being funny. It's not in the driveway where we saw it 3 hours ago. It appears someone went inside the house while we were gone. Maybe the same person who took her car. Hell no, that couldn't be Hyde. He has no way to get in. Marino looks at me as he listens. The conversation didn't start well, and it only gets worse. I can see his internal struggle. I can see it in his eyes, in the set of his heavy jaw. And I'm convinced that Carrie is playing us for Keystone Cops, for fools, and I imagine her amusement, her smug smile and laughter. We're in the midst of a nightmare of her making, because that's what she does while decent people try to live their lives and do their jobs. We're here according to plan. Not our plan, her plan. "And you got no clue," Marino is saying to Lappin over the phone. "You haven't talked to him. And when you saw him last, he didn't give you any reason to think he had something to do, someplace to go. Any reason you can think of he'd quit answering his radio and phone? Yeah, like you did. And you're home? Well, it's a damn good thing, because any minute we're going to see the exact GPS coordinates of where your phone is as we speak. Yeah, you heard me right. Sorry, buddy, but that's what happens when you disappear off the radar." It isn't really. Marino is exaggerating. Using cell towers to determine someone's exact location isn't foolproof. It can be off by 20 miles or more, depending on the software, topography, the weather, and how much signal traffic is handled by regional switching centers at any given moment. But that doesn't stop Marino from trying. If nothing else, cell phone pinging is the stuff of bluffs if he wants to scare a suspect into a confession. "Here's what we know." Marino is talking to me now as he bends down to remove his sopping wet sneakers. "Lappin claims he and Hyde pulled out of here in their respective vehicles while we were still inside the house. This would have been at about 10:15. His ankles are white and imprinted with the pattern of his socks as he peels them off. I saw them leave. I'm so cold, I'm beginning to shiver as we stand near the front door, dripping. The two of them and also Trooper Vogel, about 15 minutes before you and I headed out. I listened to him, and I also listened for the tactical team. How can big men with all that gear be so damn quiet? The warnings are fast and strong. We shouldn't be inside this house. But we've walked in, and here we are. We're safe. I keep telling myself we couldn't be safer. There are special ops cops in here, and I continue to wonder how it's possible they don't make a sound. They're silent like cats. I can't hear anything, not their feet or their voices, and my heart is beating harder. Something has happened. Suddenly, the two police divers are before me, vividly, horribly, suspended face down inside the hull of the sunken barge. Their names were Rick and Sam, and I envisioned their dead young faces, their hoses dangling, their hair floating up in the brownish, murky water as their eyes stared unblinking behind their masks. There were no bubbles. The regulators weren't inside their mouths. I remember my disbelief, my electrifying explosion of adrenaline as I realized what I was seeing were spears sticking out of their black neoprene-covered torsos. It had been only minutes earlier that the men were alive and well, cheerfully checking each other's dive gear, taking their giant strides off the stern of the boat and disappearing below the surface. I was joking with Benton about them, flashing their badges underwater, making sure nobody bothered us or interfered with our mission. We had an underwater escort. We had underwater security. Then they were dead on the bottom of the sea, ambushed, trapped, and I've never figured out what drew them into the hatch and down into the lightless hull. Why did they go in there? Carrie must have lured them somehow. Maybe she was inside waiting with the spear gun, blending with the rusty metal when she struck out of the abyss, and I hope what I always do, I hope they didn't suffer as they hemorrhaged internally and drowned, and I feel conflicted. My thoughts are louder and more adamant as they argue in rhythm to the clocks. Go stay, go stay, go stay, go stay. Lappin supposedly started feeling bad, got a headache, a tickle in his throat. Marino is saying, as I will myself to listen. Pay attention. He swung by his house for cold medicine and didn't bother notifying the radio. At least that's what he claims. And a few minutes ago, he finally marked out sick. My intuition says we should leave, and yet I can't. I need to finish what I started. I'll be damned if I'll allow Carrie Grethen to interfere with how I handle a scene. Go stay, go stay, go stay, go stay. What exactly was Lappin's understanding when he and Hyde left here this morning? I asked Marino. That Hyde was going to grab coffee, borrow the John, and then return here to secure the perimeter with crime scene tape like I told him to. Supposedly he was in a hurry because he wanted to do it before the rain started. Unless someone else strung the tape across the front steps, it would appear he did just that. He got started and then abruptly left. Look the other way, please, I tell Marino, and of course he looks right at me. Turn around. Don't look in this direction. I begin to unbutton my shirt. I take it off, and then my soggy boots, my soaked socks and cargo pants, leaving my clothing on the floor a safe distance from blood and broken glass. The tactical pants Swat picked out are so big I could put them on without unzipping them, and I fold over the waistband to tighten it a little. I put on the black shirt, and it's huge in the shoulders and waist, and the buttonholes are stubborn, the cotton fabric new and stiff. At least I have plenty of pockets for pistol magazines, pens, flashlights, knives, whatever one might need, I think ironically. I glance at myself in the mirror, and my tactical attire looks baggy and borrowed. I don't exactly look menacing without ballistic armor, helmet, night vision goggles, or the smallest caliber assault rifle, or even a pistol that holds more than 6 rounds. I can only hope that if the wrong person sees me, I don't get shot because it's assumed I'm dangerous, and I am dangerous. But not the way I'd like to be right this minute. Well, Lappin is suddenly sick thanks to you. Marino is standing with his back to me, scrolling through his phone. Why thanks to me? I sit down on the cool marble and put my wet boots back on without socks, and over them, disposable shoe covers that will prevent me from tracking water in the house. You said something about Vogel not having a tetanus shot, and maybe what he's really got is the whooping cough. Lappin's right there listening, and it's what I call power of suggestion. Suddenly he started feeling sick. Marino puts soaked sneakers back on as his phone rings again. I gather from what he says that it's his contact at the phone company. For a long moment, Marino listens. He says very little. I can tell that what he's being told isn't helpful. Or maybe he doesn't understand how it's helpful or even plausible. This is nuts, he exclaims to me when he ends the call. We pinged his phone, Hyde's phone. Yeah, we don't care about Lappin. We know where he is, at home playing hooky. The last call Hyde made was at 9:49 this morning while he was still inside this house, Marino says. The phone records showed that the call connected to a cell tower that has the exact same GPS coordinates as this house. I don't understand, I start to say. Yeah, you don't understand, because obviously there's no cell tower at this location. It doesn't exist. Marino raises his voice in frustration. In other words, Hyde's call connected to a fake tower, probably one of these cell site simulators, a phone track or something like a stingray. They're so compact these days, you can carry one in your car, in a briefcase, or maybe there's one hidden inside this house somewhere. Bad people use equipment like that. I think about Lucy and how much I wish I could talk to her. She would know about such surveillance devices. She probably could tell me exactly what's been happening on this property and who's been spying or intercepting communications and why. But law enforcement uses it too, I'm saying to Marino. There's been a lot of controversy about cops relying on such devices to capture content, to track people, or in some instances, to jam radio signals. That's right, it works both ways, spying and counter-spying, Marino says. You can track someone and intercept content or use the same device to prevent yourself from being tracked. Benton would know if the FBI's been spying on this property. If you say so. But he's not going to tell you, my guess is. He probably wouldn't. I hand Marino a dry set of clothing, size double X. Get changed. I toss him a pair of blue Tyvek shoe covers. Chapter 34. I politely avert my gaze as he drops sopping wet garments to the floor in a pile near mine, and I'm again reminded of how uncharitable crime scenes are. We can't help ourselves to privacy, a drink of water, or a toilet. I can't borrow the clothes dryer, a bath towel, or even sit in a chair. May as well get started while we wait. Marino zips up his borrowed black tactical pants, and they fit him just fine. I don't think that's wise. I roll up my cuffs so I don't trip on them. Surprising SWAT is a good way to get shot. I suggest we stay put until they say otherwise. We're fine as long as we restrict ourselves to rooms they already cleared. We don't go upstairs yet or in the basement. Marino hops on one foot, then the other, tugging the blue booties over his wet sneakers. Not until they've been there first. He clips his holstered Glock to his waistband and tucks his radio into one back pocket, his phone in the other, and picks up a scene case. We walk out of the foyer, past the stairs, into a living room crowded with formidable antiques and silk rugs in bright patterns on the heart of pine floors, and something rolls through me like a seismic tremor. My attention locks on the six white votive candles in simple glass holders on the red lacquer coffee table. They've never been lit. They aren't dusty and look new. I lean close to them, isolating the familiar scents of jasmine, tube rose, and sandalwood. I recognize musk and vanilla, the rich erotic fragrance of Amor Vero, Italian for true love, the signature perfume of the Hotel Hassler at the top of the Spanish Steps in Rome, where Benton proposed to me 8 years ago. I have Amor Vero perfume, bath oil, and body lotion at home. He always buys it for my birthday, and now I smell it here inside this house. I sniff my wrists to make sure it isn't me, even though I know it can't be. I didn't put it on this morning. What do you smell? I ask Marino. He sniffs, shrugs. An old house? Maybe flowers? But my nose is stuffed up because of all the dust in this place. It's like it's been closed up for a long time. Have you noticed? Do you recognize anything? Like what? What you described as a flowery fragrance, is it familiar? Yeah. It smells sort of like what you wear, now that you mention it. He walks closer to me, sniffs a few more times. That's because it's the same fragrance, but I don't have it on right now. It's also uncommon, and I rarely run into it anywhere. Benton has to order it from Italy. You're saying it's your special scent. Sweat is popping out on top of Marino's shaved head, and people close to you would know it. That's what I'm saying, I reply, and he's thinking the same thing I am. It's like the clocks, Marino says. I walked through this room this morning, and I know the clocks weren't working. I didn't hear them. I don't remember seeing these little white candles or smelling anything in here except dust. The candles haven't been used. I point a gloved finger at one on the side table, and if I pick one up, I do it as I say it. There's no sparing, no round shape in the dust on the tabletop. It appears the candles were placed here recently, and the room hasn't been cleaned in a while. Marino's eyes dart around as the clocks tick-tock, tick-tock, and the rain drums the roof louder, softer, then in a hard roll. The wind rushes and moans as I listen for the tactical team. I turn on alabaster sconces and a chandelier, and they glow wanly. The centuries-old oil paintings of landscapes, the stern portraits on the oak-paneled walls are just as dark, the room just as gloomy. An elaborately embroidered screen blocks off the deep brick fireplace, and I don't see any indication it's ever used. I don't smell the stale, acrid odor of old burned wood and soot. I don't see sawdust, firewood, or fire logs, and I think how dreary. Even on a sunny day, it would be. There's no television, and I can't find a sound system or speakers anywhere, and there are no magazines or newspapers. Not that I can imagine reading in here or relaxing with a friend. The room is vast and unlived in, and as I stand silently and look around, I detect a vague spectrum of other odors. Musty upholstery, mothballs. Dust is on every surface and suspended in the overhead light, and I entertain stronger doubts about Chanel Gilbert's housekeeper. The living room hasn't been used or cleaned in quite a while, I tell Marino, as I wander toward a menagerie of antique silver animals arranged on a pedestal table. A horse, a grouse, a bison, a fish with glassy eyes, intricately handcrafted, but tarnished and cold, and I see nothing whimsical. The decor is splendid, but static and impersonal, except for what I think of as talismans, symbols and tools of divination, and the clocks. Several are as old as the house, including a lantern clock and a Swiss Gothic one. I can't imagine the housekeeper has been keeping this place up properly, I add, and I'm keenly mindful of the tactical team and what it's doing. The master bedroom's way in the back if you keep following the hallway. Marino walks to a window and pushes aside a panel of the deep red French jacquard curtains. It's a long hall to the front door if you're in bed and someone rings the bell. He looks out at the dark, rainy afternoon, and I hear the downpour and the wind, but nothing else. I don't know what they pay Elsa Mulligan or how many hours she works, but they aren't getting their money's worth. I continue making the point because Marino isn't interested in my domestic acumen, and he should be. I try to envision Elsa Mulligan based on how she's been described, imagining her large framed glasses, her spiky black hair. Hyde commented that his first reaction was he assumed she was a family friend from Los Angeles. And she seems an odd choice for a housekeeping job. Clearly, she isn't thorough or industrious, at least not about cleaning. If she shows up at 8 o'clock every morning, then what does she do while she's here? What she told Hyde strikes me as yet one more story we're supposed to believe that isn't adding up. Assuming Chanel was in the back of the house and wearing nothing but a robe, you have to wonder how her body ended up near the front door, Marino is saying, while my mind runs along multiple tracks and I listen for creaking floors, for closing doors, for voices. There's no way maybe the housekeeper moved the body in there. Chanel wasn't killed in one place and then dragged or carried into the foyer, if that's what you're asking. But the wiped-up blood we could see when you sprayed the marble, Marino considers. Maybe there's other bloody areas that have been washed up. I suspect the goal of cleaning up blood in the foyer was to give us an initial impression of an accident. If you fall off a ladder, you aren't going to leave impact blood spatter all over the place. I look around and listen for the tactical team. If you want to lure people down the wrong path at the onset, then you'd better clean up any blood or other evidence that doesn't fit with whatever it is you're staging, I add, as we wait for any sign that there are four big men inside the house with us. I listen to the rain and the clocks. Gusting wind rattles the windows. I hear nothing else. And this person knew you'd find wiped up blood and figure it out eventually. Marino gets closer to saying what, by now, I'm sure is the inevitable and unfortunate truth. There's no question Chanel was murdered where she was found. It's obvious, right? Based on the blood pattern, yes, I reply. She received her fatal injuries while she was down on the marble floor. That doesn't mean that's where the encounter started. Like someone got her on the floor without much of a struggle and started slamming her head. Based on my initial examination, the CT scan, and what Luke told me, that's the way it looks. We've seen this before, Doc. Marino doesn't mean in general. He's alluding to blunt force trauma deaths that occurred in the past year when a realtor named Patty Marsico was beaten to death in Nantucket, and young Gracie Smithers died similarly on a rocky shore in Marblehead. Carrie Grethen has a habit of bashing people's brains out like that. He's on her trail, locked in with no turning back. In several homicides we're aware of, at any rate. The one in Nantucket last Thanksgiving. He heads there as a crow flies. Then the one in Marblehead in June. She mixes up her M.O.s. Beatings, a stabbing, shootings with the PGF, a spear gun. Indoors, outdoors, on land, on a boat, underwater. Whatever the hell she feels like. He leans close to the handcrafted silver fish on the pedestal table, nudging the articulated tail with his purple nitrile-sheathed knuckle. This is kind of strange. It's actually a box. Anger hardens his tone as he carefully picks it up and the tail moves, the eyes staring at me. A heavy one. Must be solid silver, except I can't open it because it's glued shut. I can smell the glue, so it wasn't applied all that long ago. Maybe while we were gone. Maybe while the clocks were being wound. I don't hear anything loose inside, as he shakes it a little. So here's what I have to say, Doc. What happened to Chanel Gilbert is personal. It's sexual. This isn't about a burglary or some other crime that got out of control and ended in murder. It's obvious what we've got is sick and demented, and we're being jerked around, and we know by who. Of course, that's just me talking. I'm not that kind of expert. I'm not Benton. I've paused by the fireplace to look at the clocks, at the bookcases filled with leather-bound books on either side of the wide stone hearth. It's all about power, I tell him, as he squats by the scene case and begins pulling out trays. Everything with her is about power. That's what she loves. It's what sexually excites and drives her. You don't have to be a profiler to figure that out. Marino finds a small plastic bottle labeled acetone and returns to the small table next to the cherry sofa with black leather cushions. He picks up the silver fish box in his gloved hands. Let's hope it's not a bomb. He's almost joking. If it is, then I'll just kiss my ass goodbye. He finds camera equipment. And mine, by the way. Someone glued the lid on. And I don't think it was all that long ago. I want to know why. He starts taking photographs of the box. The other alternative is to bring in the bomb squad. Maybe Amanda Gilbert would like to watch. Let's see what else we can do to put her on the friggin' warpath. He digs in the scene cases for fingerprint powder and brushes. I peruse old books as he checks the silver box for latent prints, finding not so much as a smudge. He swabs for DNA, and he's getting angrier and more aggressive. He's feeling manipulated and mocked. I know when the pressure is building inside Marino, and he's about to blow. I mean, you think it's her. He angrily rips open a packet of swabs. By now, you don't have any second thoughts. It's not a question. He's telling me as if there can be no doubt, and there isn't. We know. Yes, I reply. And you've been thinking it all day. It's been on my mind since I started getting the videos. I slide books off shelves, opening them, looking for any indication they meant something to someone. I think it's a foregone conclusion who we're dealing with. But usually you'd be on the phone to Benton. Marino dips a swab in acetone. And except when we were leaving Lucy's house, you haven't been in touch with them at all. Not even before you knew he was up in the helicopter. You've been shutting him out of everything. I offer no answer or explanation. I'm not going to discuss Benton with him. And I continue to scan musty-smelling books that, without exception, are arcane. Fly fishing, hunting dogs, gardening, stone masonry in 19th-century England. I've come across similar miscellaneous collections in homes accessorized by interior decorators who buy antique books by the yard. Most of what you're seeing is impersonal, I inform Marino, but he's distracted. Except for the hourglasses, the spinning wheels, the candles, the iron crosses, and the clocks, I add. And he isn't paying attention. They're not part of the decor. They seem collected for some reason, possibly a symbolic one. I say nothing more. Marino has the silver box open and is walking toward me. His face is an angry dark red. He holds both halves of the silver box in one gloved hand, pointing the fish's head away from us. He touches his finger to his lips at the same instant I hear movement in the central hallway. Looks like she read strange stuff. Marino makes bland small talk, alerting me that there's a problem. We've been talking inside this house, and shouldn't have been. We've been discussing this case and Carrie, and someone has been listening. I can very well imagine who. I don't think anybody's been reading these books, I add to our mundane discussion as the small black device inside the fish box continues to record us. The eyes are actually pinholes for the mini recorder lens and microphone, and I'm reminded of the electric pencil sharpener in Lucy's Quantico dorm room. I remember the dragon in her rock garden and the garnet Mona Lisa eyes that seem to follow me. I feel the hair prickle on my arms and the back of my neck, even as I act as if nothing is wrong. I doubt these were collected because someone wanted to read them, I'm saying to Marino, as he carries the silver box and its concealed recording device to the other side of the room. I suspect what you're seeing is an example of the L.A. influence. It's as if much of her home was designed like a movie set, with eclectic antiques, rugs, and old paintings of people in places that likely had no connection to anyone that matters. And that means what to you, besides Chanel Gilbert comes from Hollywood money? He opens a paper evidence bag as we continue to talk as if nothing is abnormal. It tells me she parked herself here, but she lived somewhere else, possibly metaphorically. I feel a presence and turn around. The four officers in black ballistic gear are in the doorway. Chapter 35. Marino folds the top of the brown paper bag, sealing it with red tape. Battery-operated wireless, and probably installed not all that long ago. He says this to Ajax, who suggests they call in the Cyber Investigation Unit to sweep the house for surveillance devices. We should get that going ASAP, he adds. Not until we're done and the hell out of here. I don't need any more cops stomping through. Marino finds a Sharpie in the scene case. Thanks a lot. I wasn't talking about you. I meant the Geek Squad. And while they're at it, they also should look for anything capable of jamming radio signals and rerouting cell phone traffic. Marino uses his teeth to pull the cap off a Sharpie. Someone might be listening. Where there's one device, there are probably others, Ajax warns him. These days, I assume there's cameras everywhere. Let them listen. Screw whoever it is, including the feds. Hello, feds, Marino says loudly, rudely. So nice of you to join us. Nothing caught my attention when we were looking around, but that doesn't mean you've got privacy. Like I said, I never assume I've got privacy, except hopefully in my own home. Ajax is talking to both of us. And even there we got cameras. But I know where they are in that case. Maybe Chanel Gilbert didn't have privacy either. Maybe she was being spied on. Marino just keeps on talking. Or maybe she was blocking any attempt at someone spying on her. No matter which it is, we should be asking the same question. Who the hell was she, and what was she involved in? You're clear in here, Ajax lets us know, but his eyes are riveted to me now. I know what his opinion is. He doesn't have to say it, and out of respect for me, he won't. But he wears his doubt like a sandwich sign, and there can be no question what he would advise if asked. He'd point out that if the situation merits a special response team searching the property, then I shouldn't be here. To tactical operators, to troops involved in the active warfare of military and sting operations, I'm non-essential personnel. If the order on any given day is kill or be killed, then justice and the way something might play out in court are low on the list. They may not be on the list at all. The Ajaxes of the world aren't the excavators, the scientists who have to interpret and decipher what they discover. Special ops shoot the cobras. It's up to me to figure out if it was merited. That's my job. I walked off it earlier today. I won't again. No sign of anyone upstairs or down, Ajax continues to brief us. In fact, if you ask me, it doesn't look like most of the house has been lived in for a while, other than the master bedroom at the back of this floor. Someone's definitely using that. Or was. He waits near the doorway. The three other cops behind him in the hallway, their forearms resting on the matte black stocks of the rifles across their chests, barrels pointed down, their night vision goggles flipped up on their helmets. When they shift their weight or move, they are subtle and silent. They're agile and non-reactive. They're disciplined, stoical, what I consider the perfect hero blend of selflessness and narcissism. You have to love yourself if you're going to fight gloriously and bravely, if you're going to survive at any price while protecting a person or a people with your life. It's a contradiction. It seems illogical. It's not a stereotype or a cliche when I say that special ops aren't like the rest of us. So, unless there's anything else, Ajax asks Marino. Nothing right now except for whatever's happened to hide. He finishes labeling the bag and puts the cap back on the Sharpie, tosses it into the top tray of the open Pelican case. I heard from Lappin, but still nothing from Hyde. We know he made a phone call from here before he left this morning, and it's just more of the same crazy crap. We ping his phone, and it comes back to a cell tower right here that doesn't exist. It sounds to me like someone is scrambling, jamming radio signals, turning this location into a dead zone for communications. Unless he uses his phone again, we won't get anything else. Ajax joins his team in the hallway. If you don't hit send, there's no signal, and we can't find you. It's unusual that he's not used his phone for the past 3 hours. Unless you're sick, disabled, or someplace that makes you turn it off, you're gonna use your phone for something. No shit, Marino says. Are you sure his phone's not here somewhere? One of the other cops asks. Any possibility he might have dropped it, set it down, and doesn't have it with him? I mean, we didn't see it anywhere, but that doesn't mean it's not here. What happens when you call his number? It goes straight to voicemail, like the phone's turned off or the battery's dead. Marino tries Hyde's number again. Straight to voicemail, just like it's been doing. It's on the air that we're looking for him and his car, Ajax says. Everybody's looking from here to Timbuktu. I'll get a couple backups on the perimeters so you two don't get lonely. We won't be here much longer. Marino slides his phone back into a pocket. The doc wants a walkthrough of the important areas, and then we're out. I need the backup units to stay in place until we find Hyde, until we figure out what happened to the victim's Range Rover. No one unauthorized steps foot on this property or inside the house unless I say. Roger that, Ajax says. You know where to find me. Marino and I watch them leave, disappearing down the hallway, past the staircase into the foyer. I listen for the front door to shut. I can barely make out the sound of their SUV starting up. I'm keenly aware that we're alone again, and I feel the emptiness and the silence as Marino returns to the foyer. He leaves the taped-up paper bag and other evidence near the door. You heard what he said, I say as he walks back to me. If there's one covert device, there could be others. I would count on it. Ready? He snaps shut the scene case and picks it up. Back into the hallway, and the next right is the dining room, small with a low ceiling, the table built of an old barn door and surrounded by 8 rustic brown leather chairs. Overhead is a Tiffany pendant chandelier, and I scan the dark oil pastoral scenes beneath gallery lights. The paintings depict cows and rolling hills and meadows and mountains, 17th and 18th century English and Dutch. The dishes in the Georgian breakfront cabinet are very old Chinese porcelain, and I detect the hand of a decorator again. Pale gold damask draperies are drawn over the glass sliders, and I part the heavy satiny fabric. I look out at a narrow side yard hemmed in by a wrought iron fence. Rain splashes deep puddles that are like small ponds, and rose petals litter the lawn like pastel confetti. The fence terminates at a tall, dense boxwood hedge at the back of the property. I notice loose bricks and large stones, a hint of ruins possibly from an outbuilding in an earlier, more gracious era, and I'm reminded of the people of New England. They'll work around and build on the past, but they'll never get rid of it. Then I hear it again, a muffled thud, as if someone just slammed a door a floor below us in the cellar. What the hell was that? Marino's hand drops to his gun. Stay here, he orders me, as if I'd ever consider such a thing. I'm not staying anywhere alone in this house. I follow him past the staircase, and he opens the door I saw him use this morning, flipping on lights. I'm checking, he says. I'm right behind you. The wooden stairs leading down are very old and scuffed, and the walls are stone. I feel as if I'm descending into the bowels of an old English castle as I take one steep step at a time, slowly, pausing every other second, and careful with my leg. The air is cool. I smell dust. I detect fluctuations in light and shadow, as if clouds are passing over the sun, but there are no clouds down here. There's no sun. The cellar is sub-basement, and there are no windows. What's moving? I ask Marino. There's a light barely moving on the wall. I don't know. He's in front of me with his gun drawn. 10 steps, and then a landing, and 4 more steps, and we're inside an empty, windowless space of stone and plaster walls, and I scan stone-pillared archways and a rough stone floor covered with rush mats. Suspended by braided fabric cords from the high cave-like ceiling are ceramic funnel lamps, and the one closest to the bulkhead doors is swinging slightly. We silently stare up at it, then at the double doors, the wood gray on this side, repainted many times, and I notice dried water spots. The doors were opened at some point when it was raining. They're built into the wall about 4 feet off the ground and accessed by a stone ramp that is bone dry and very clean. I notice that the latch lock is modern, and the key is in it. There's no sign that the doors are alarmed, and Marino pushes them with a Tyvek-covered shoe. They don't budge. He looks up at the lamp swaying imperceptibly now, as if touched by a spirit or a draft. "What we just heard wasn't these doors shutting," he decides. "If someone had just gone out this way, they wouldn't be locked, not with the key still inside. And rain would have gotten in. There'd be water and dirt that washed in from the flower bed." Not if the person cleaned up afterward. Marino holds his Glock in his right hand, the barrel pointed down as he walks to another door, this one in the far wall, a normal pedestrian door painted white. He climbs the 4 stone steps leading up to it. "Locked and deadbolted." His Tyvek-covered feet make a slippery sound on stone as he returns to me. "I don't know why the hell this light was moving unless something ran into it, maybe flew into it. This joint probably has bats." "We definitely heard what sounded like a door shutting, and we've heard it more than once today. Are you suggesting bats are responsible for that, too?" I say as my phone rings, and I'm surprised I have a signal down here. I look at the display. It's Jen Garrett. She's parking on the driveway, and I tell her to meet me at the top of the steps near the supercans at the east side of the house. "Why is there a roll of crime scene tape in the flower bed by those big wooden doors?" she asks. "I assume you noticed it." "Stay away from the front of the house," I tell her. "Meet me exactly where I just told you, and don't touch anything." I use Tyvek as an umbrella, holding a disposable lab coat over my head as I step outside on the landing. The rain is steady but not as hard, the sky lighter to the south. I block the open door. I hope if we stay out here we won't be overheard by any interior surveillance devices that might be hidden somewhere. Beyond that, there's nothing I can do. And it's not the first time I've worried about drop cams, nanny cams, and other home security devices that are increasingly common and easy to use. When I work a crime scene these days, it always enters my mind that what we do and say may not be private. Jen Garrett climbs out of the CFC SUV she's parked in front of my truck. Dressed in rain gear, she trots toward me, her rubber boots splashing through water as if she's having great fun. She's loud on the wooden steps. She's excited as we exchange keys, her wet fingers fumbling and pushy. "Don't go into the back of the truck except to remove the packaged evidence," I instruct her, and I'm not friendly or about to let her into the house. That's what she wants. It's obvious she's desperate to come inside. They're in the first locker. I'm all business as I explain. "Receipt the packages to Ernie after you've left the truck in the evidence bay. He'll take it from there." "I need more details about what happened to it." Her long dark hair is tied back, her eyes intensely blue beneath her baseball cap as she stares past me into the kitchen. "I've given you the information you need for now." "I'm happy to come in and help," she says. "It must be complicated, or you wouldn't have been out here earlier and come back. Marino's with you?" "He is." It's my way of reminding her that she's not to interrogate me.
"Hey, don't mess with me, because I know he's with you."
She's teasing seductively, talking fast as if she's on speed.
"I've heard his radio chatter. That officer he's looking for, what's his name? Hyde, as in Dr. Jekyll? Just so you know, it's on Twitter that Cambridge PD is looking for him, that there's an APB because it appears he vanished off the radar and they can't find his police cruiser. Do you know what happened? I'm not the one listening to radio chatter. You tell me. I don't answer her questions, and I don't like the way she continues looking past me and inching closer to the open door. I can finish up in here with Marino so you can get back. She doesn't offer, but says it like a directive, and I feel my dislike of her intensify. Jen Garrett is pretty in a bad girl way. Mid-30s with olive skin and a full-bodied figure that she loves to flaunt. When she applied for the job, I didn't give much thought to her tattoos and gothic jewelry or her snug, skimpy clothing, and none of that is my real problem with her. What I have come to object to and resent are her invasiveness and histrionics. Everything she does is motivated by her own brand of exhibitionism. She can be digging up skeletal remains or recovering a dead body from a river and somehow makes it a sexy spectator sport. Please get the truck back as discussed, I tell her, and I'll see you and everyone shortly, I hope. She lingers on the top step as rain smacks her rain suit, dark blue with forensics in yellow on the back. A sly smile, a smirk creep over her face. Sorry to hear about Lucy, she says, and I don't react. I play dumb as Marino's heavy footsteps enter the kitchen. What do you mean you're sorry about her? I ask Jen calmly, as if there is nothing on earth that might bother me right now. Well, from the way I hear it, the helicopter buzzing her house this morning wasn't hers. And where might you have heard such a thing? I ask, and Marino is behind me in the kitchen. I step inside next to him, both of us out of the rain and leaving her in it. Is Lucy in trouble? Jen stares at him. I sort of have a right to know. I mean, even you have a right to know, Pete. Doesn't matter that you aren't at the CFC anymore. You and Lucy are really close, so if she's in trouble with the feds, don't you think you should be aware that everyone around her should be? What makes you think she's in trouble? He asks. Bapern. The Boston Area Police Emergency Radio Network includes more than 100 different local agencies and the state police and the FBI. I can't imagine why anything about Lucy or her property would have been broadcast over Bapern. I know the FBI had a chopper up, and it was pretty obvious where it was, Jen explains. Lucy's big spread in Concord. Oh, yeah? And why would the feds be talking about one of their tactical helicopters over Bapern? Marino glowers at her. The answer is they wouldn't. They'd be on the air traffic control freak. It wasn't the feds talking. It was the Concord cops. Plus your big truck was complained about. She directs this to me. You blocked in an FBI car or something? Apparently a Concord cruiser checked out why the chopper was flying over Lucy's house, and there was talk about our truck blocking an FBI car. No shit, Marino says snidely. And guess what? It's not our job to answer your questions. You need to leave. I'm not asking questions. I'm telling you stuff you clearly don't know. We don't need your help. Maybe you're not smart enough to ask for it. She stares defiantly at him, and I can't believe it. He slams the door shut in her face. The last thing I see is Jen Garrett's mouth dropping open as she protests. I move to the window over the sink. I stand there looking out as she goes down the steps. She follows the walkway and drives off in the big white truck, and I feel satisfaction when the tires slide off the bricks and bump through mud. She overcorrects, fishtailing slightly. I drive the damn thing better than she does. Chapter 36. The old saying that you are what you eat has morbid implications if you're me. I can tell a lot about people from what's in their cupboards and trash. Marino and I are searching the kitchen now as I caution him about Jen. It's not the first time and likely won't be the last.
The empty trash can is exactly as we left it. No bag inside, the plastic liner pulled up far enough to keep the lid open. I just wish you wouldn't, I'm saying. You know me, I'm always honest. He shuts a drawer of potholders and dish towels. Please don't give her any reason to sue the CFC. Calling it a hostile workplace, for example, because people like you slam doors in her face, I don't care if it's honest. I don't like her, and it's not because she has my old job. Inside the refrigerator, I scan shelves of bottled water and juices and white wine, sticks of butter and condiments. I think about Chanel's gastric contents. It would seem she ate a seafood dish, possibly a Creole gumbo, stew, or soup, shortly before she was murdered. But I don't see fresh vegetables, such as peppers and onions, or anything that suggests she cooked such a thing, and there's no takeout box. I begin to wonder about the trash that's disappeared. I mention it in a guarded way to Marino, knowing our every word may be monitored. I let him know I'm not seeing anything that might indicate someone has eaten or prepared food in recent memory. The only exception is the cold-pressed fresh juices. There are 5 glass bottles of them, deep red concoctions. I open one and smell ginger, cayenne, pepper, kale, and beets. I seriously doubt the perishable drinks are available in any grocery store I've been to in the Cambridge area, and I'm again reminded that this house isn't even 2 miles from mine. It's barely 10 minutes from my office. It's possible Chanel Gilbert and I shopped, gassed up our cars, ran errands in some of the same places. A lot of these fresh juice companies deliver, I'm saying to Marino, and this particular brand isn't one I've ever seen in a store. He picks up a bottle of the dark red juice, turns it in his hand, inspecting the label. The name of the company is One Octan. It occurs to me the bottles look like the ones I saw in a bag in the back of the red Range Rover. No company address anywhere. No expiration date. Sort of looks like a computer-generated label. Sort of homemade. He returns the bottle to the shelf, takes off his gloves, and dips into a pocket for his phone. And now I'm Googling it, and nothing. There's no such company. A freaky name. Maybe as in octane? Like a high-octane superfuel or food? Or in 1-octan-3-1, I suggest. The molecular composition for the odorant that, depending on other things, causes blood to smell metallic. Blood? This particular blend of juice obviously is heavy in beets, explaining the deep red color. Like blood, like the essence, the fluid of life. Beets are high in iron, and iron is what we smell when blood touches our skin. 1-octan is an odd, if not distasteful, name for a food. Maybe Chanel Gilbert bottled it herself. Like I said, it sort of looks homemade. Then we need to find a juicer, a food processor, a ninja, and I don't see anything like that here in the kitchen. Well, maybe she was into vampires in addition to all the occult shit everywhere, he says sarcastically. It appears that she or someone was vegan and on a gluten-free diet. I'm looking in the pantry now. Nothing with wheat. No cheese, fish, or meat in her refrigerator or freezer. Lots of herbal teas and nutritional supplements. Again, there's nothing perishable except the juice. I refrain from telling him about Chanel Gilbert's gastric contents. Vegans would abstain from shrimp or any seafood, and yet that seems to be the last thing she ate before she was murdered. Was she out at a restaurant last night? Was the food delivered or brought to her by someone she knew? Are remnants of her last meal in the trash that's missing? Was she really vegan? I don't give voice to such questions. I don't want anyone spying on us, gifted with autopsy details. I retrieve an evidence bag from the scene case,
deciding to take a bottle of the red juice with me because it's inconsistent with the context. The juices are fresh. Nothing else is. It's as if nobody has been living here for a while, and yet someone has been. I'm seeing things that contradict each other. I'm picking up mixed signals. Suddenly, and in unison, the clocks begin to chime. It's 3 p.m. Next, there's a burst of radio chatter. Marino turns up the volume, adjusts the squelch, and there's a report of a fight in progress in a parking lot on North Point Boulevard.
Two white males, possibly juveniles, in a late model red SUV. One has on a baseball cap, the other a sweatshirt with a hood, apparently intoxicated and arguing outside the vehicle, the dispatcher is saying, and a marked unit responds that it's in the area, then another one does. Marino tucks the radio back in a pocket.
Come on, Doc, he says to me with a sigh. Let's get this over with.
We head down a hallway of wide board pine flooring that I suspect is original to the house. The walls are stucco and hung with more old dark English art. A doorway leads into an oak-paneled library that's a gallery of underwater photographs illuminated by vintage mirrored sconces that have been electrified. Built-in bookcases are crowded with more antique leather volumes, most likely purchased as decor, and for a moment I stand in the doorway, conducting my usual high recon, as Lucy calls it. I take in the exposed dark timber beams in the white plaster ceiling, the wood-burning stove built into a deep stone fireplace. The wide board floor is covered with rush mats just like the ones in the cellar, and between the two curtained windows is an inlaid mahogany and satinwood writing desk. The computer that was on it has been taken to the labs, Marino informs me. I begin to walk around the library table. It's at least 10 feet long, with a parquetry top and an elaborately hand-carved base. In the center is an empty crystal decanter, several small glasses, and another clock tick-tocking. This one tortoiseshell, gilt and colorful enamel, possibly late 18th century and musical. I check my watch. It's now exactly 4 minutes past 3 p.m. The clock has been synced with the others. Was there any other indication that Chanel Gilbert worked in here? What else was on the desk? I begin looking at the framed photographs of sea turtles, eagle rays, and barracuda. There are rainbow parrotfish, Spanish lobster, a queen conch, and a Goliath grouper near the shadowy carcasses of sunken ships. The water is vivid shades of green and blue, and sunlight filters through it from the surface. In here we collected the computer, one of these Mac Pro desktops. Marino watches me look around at dive scenes vibrantly reflected in the mirrored sconces. Plus we got her phone. She also has a router, but there was no point in taking that, the TV and other electronics, not at that time. What about a laptop, an iPad, any other devices? He shakes his head. And I wonder who doesn't have a laptop or an iPad these days, but we don't discuss it. I take my time perusing the sea creatures and sunken vessels as another bad feeling billows up from the darkest depths of my psyche. It slowly comes to me that what I'm seeing is familiar. I look more closely and begin to recognize the scattered remains of the Greek steamer, the Pelinion, that sank during World War II.